Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time!
In today's episode of Early Stoppage, we're going back. We're throwing it back from 93 to 2013, the first 20 years in the sport, in the UFC. Let's get into it.
There ain't really much out there that's popping off without us, fella. We just want the credit where it's due. I'm a worry about me, give a rip about you, fella, just as a reminder to myself. I wear every single chain, even when I'm in the house, because we started from the bottom, now we're here.
And with that, welcome to Early Stoppage, a show where the news of the day is usually given just enough time, but sometimes not enough. I'm John Franklin. I'll be joined shortly, as always, by Craig Allen. On this episode of Early Stoppage, we're going to give you a rundown of the show, as many of you will be new to it. And then we'll get into this week's throwback edition, looking back at the first 20 years in UFC history from 1993 to 2013. Craig, you say let's get into it, so let's get into it.
John, just realized I'm going to have to change the overlay for you guys listening on an audio podcast. I just realized that I put 93 to 2003 because I can't count to 20. I can only count to 10. I will change that in post-production. But hey, I mean, welcome to Early Stoppage with Fight Night Picks. It's a little bit different from This Week in MMA, question mark kicks or significant strikes. And we've got a new person joining the fold. So John Franklin, thanks for joining us. Question for you. Okay, so let's get the lowdown. Where and when did you start out in the MMA space? Where did Early Stoppage kind of come from, and what can we expect with this show?
So I started out in the MMA space kind of with Cage Pages, which was sort of fan-sided early days. Then I went over to Combat Press, did some work at MMA Today, spent some time with Sure Dog, did some stuff with, I'm still doing some stuff with Loudmouth MMA. So basically it's been a lot of like writing early on, podcasting now. That's the stuff that I prefer to do. I like to come up with new takes and different ways to do shows. Obviously you and I are going to create a bunch of new content. The show for me is just kind of like one of those shows where I like to hit a lot of topics. I like to have a lot of segments. I like to, you know, move through it very quickly. So I started it a while back with another guy in the MMA space. It just wasn't a fit. It wasn't the same. And then, you were on Between the Links over on Loudmouth. I heard some of the stuff you did, and I was like, you know what, this might be a good fit. So I reached out to you. We did a couple episodes. You know, the first two went great, and we were like, let's just keep doing this thing. So a lot of it is, the show is a segment-heavy show, and it's always different. So if you listen to it on Loudmouth, it will be similar, not the same. Obviously, Fight Night Picks has its own way of doing things, and we're going to sort of steer into that. But, you know, it's a segment-based thing, and we like to take everything and sort of get as much of the MMA world space into all these different segments.
And it's not like anything else that's on Fight Night Picks right now, because typically, you know, with question mark kicks, I usually ask the same questions getting ready for a big UFC event. What's the fight of the night? This and that. With This Week in MMA, we have our own segments, and we keep them the same just about every week. And same thing with Significant Strikes. But with this, it's going to be totally different. I think everybody's going to enjoy it, and I really appreciate that. You didn't have to pump my tires, but I really look forward to the show, and I'm glad that we could bring it over here. So
thing I want to add, the thing that fascinates me the most about the show is that we can tackle very serious topics. We can be silly. Like, we're all over the map. There's so many different things that come to this. I feel like we're not sort of like, there's not necessarily a tone. There's not necessarily a theme. The theme is that we just talk about everything and we give it a lot of thought and we take unique perspectives on it. That's pretty much all we do, and if that needs to be silly, it's silly. If that needs to be serious, it's serious. And we kind of have that freedom to kind of move around and flexibility.
And even with the show that we have coming up, I mean, you're not going to find, unless we go from 2013 on, you're going to be hard pressed to find as intense of a throwback edition as this one. So I'm looking forward to this, and I'll let you carry on.
All right, Craig, when we compare 1993 and 2013 directly against each other, we can see how evolved the sport has gotten. It started off with fighters like Royce Gracie specializing in jiu-jitsu and Gerard Gordeaux in savate at UFC 1. And by 2013, while we did have some specialists, the likes of Damian Maia or Ronda Rousey submitting everyone in sight, the majority of fighters had become much more well-rounded. Style for style, would the stars of the early UFC events be able to hack it with the fighters in 2013?
Not a single chance. No way in hell. Could you imagine if like Taylor Tooley fought like Alistair Overeem in 2013? It wouldn't even be fun. It'd be Hawaii 5-0 meets the Dutch kickboxing legend. If you can think of somebody from like the first couple of UFCs that could make it in 2013, you'd be a genius. I mean, Ken Shamrock, maybe. He fought in 2013 against Royce Gracie. But like, I don't know who could fight from 1993 in 2013.
All right, so let's run them down. Might as well. Gerard Gordeaux, Taylor Tooley, Kevin Rogier, Zane Frazier, Royce Gracie, Art Jimerson, Ken Shamrock, Pat Smith. Right out of the gate, God love him. I've talked to him before. Art Jimerson's out of there.
No, I think he'd be good. Like one boxing glove, one not. I think he'd do well in 2013.
Maybe. Let me flip this question on you, even though I asked it. Well, let me finish my thought. So Jimerson's out of there. Frazier and Rogier. Actually, Kevin Rogier was like the early Chris Weidman. I remember he's coming back to me now. The fact that he beat Zane Frazier. See, that's the thing that makes this interesting. If Kevin Rogier can beat Zane Frazier, then I have to eliminate Zane Frazier because I would eliminate Kevin Rogier. So maybe just Ken Shamrock, maybe Pat Smith. We'll see. As we think about this more, but my question is, do you think anybody in 2013 could have went back and won the tournament? Or do you think it's a slam dunk they would have, or do you think it's a different skill set?
Again, like the fighter that I threw down when I wrote the question, if you put, and he's my guy, everybody knows he's my guy. If you put Damian Maia in there instead of Royce Gracie, I think Damian Maia could have beat Royce Gracie. Like, yeah, I think in 2013, there's plenty of fighters you could have thrown in there. You could have even thrown throw Fabricio Verdum from 2013 in the 1993's The Ultimate Fighting Championship. Yeah, he would have mopped the floor with everybody. He would have been bigger than Ken Shamrock, but with the jiu-jitsu skills of Royce Gracie, like, yeah, he'd be like a triple threat everywhere. I think there's plenty of fighters. I think he could have put – and this is an argument that people would have made in 2013. Remember when people used to say, Ronda Rousey, she could have boxed the men's bantamweight in 2013. Remember that? I remember that. You could have put Ronda Rousey in the first Ultimate Fighter, and I bet she would have had a fighting chance.
Wow, you're making some statements. All right, so you know, typically how I do this kind of stuff, I find a list of the UFC champions, I run down and figure out, line up with the year. So this would be interesting. August 31st, 2013, Anthony Pettis fought Gilbert Melendez. Could you imagine Anthony Pettis in those early days? A guy that complete? Now listen, did he end up being who he thought he was going to be? No. But in 2013, this guy was like, if you took all those guys – and made a guy, except for, you know, the sumo guy. but yeah, I don't know, man. I'm a nostalgia guy. I'm older than you are. So I would like to think that some of these guys could have held their own. I'd like to think that Royce Gracie could have held his own. But when he fought Matt Hughes at UFC 60, he wasn't that far removed from his greatness. You know, he wasn't that disconnected. I mean, it was obviously 59 numbered UFC events after the first one. So with that came some, you know, some time and all that. But, you know, if we talk about when they went down, okay, so UFC 1 went down November 12th, 1993. UFC 60 went down May 27th of 2006. So that's 13 years, you know? Yeah. So I'm with you. I think that, and that's still, you know, 6 years before we're talking about the 2013. So I don't know, man. I'm with you. I get caught up in my nostalgia and sometimes would like to think those guys could. But it took a minute, and we'll get into this in a second. It took a minute before we started seeing more evolved fighters.
Yeah, which is the thing. So let's get into it. So, John, last week, somewhere else, we profiled the divisions through the years. And when we got to the light heavyweight division, I think it might have surprised you because I talked a lot about Frank Shamrock versus Tito Ortiz at UFC 22. It was a back-and-forth fight. It was one of those ones where you had wrestling, you had striking, it meshed so well together. And it's one of those fights that you probably wouldn't have seen back in 1999. So why was this fight so important? And without feeding a fed horse, what developed following this fight?
Well, I think that that fight, and I don't want to say only that fight, but that fight set the table for the skill set you needed to have to be successful prior to that fight. And I don't want to just say exclusively prior to that fight, but prior to that fight, you could be Mark Coleman, or you could be Don Fry, or you could be Dan Severn, or you could be these kind of one-trick ponies and make things happen. Frank Shamrock, even to an extent, a guy like Maury Smith, right? Yes, was he a kickboxer? 100%. The only reason he beat Mark Coleman, though, is because he trained takedown defense with the aforementioned Frank Shamrock. So it wasn't like he just walked in there as a kickboxer and took care of Mark Coleman. It was more, as the UFCs had gone along, to me, it was more like it was still only one style that was dominant, but that style had varied. Now, were there anomalies? Of course. Marco Huas was a very, you know, well-dimensioned fighter. Ken Shamrock was a well-dimensioned. I mean, there was guys who were out there sort of, you know, showing us other ways that it could be done. But, you know, for the most part, it was heavyweight champions. So let's go down the list of heavyweight champions prior to that fight. Mark Coleman, Maury Smith, Randy Couture. Now, Boss Rutten, okay, he was unique. But Kevin Randleman defeated Pete Williams the very next card, which was UFC 23. He was kind of a wrestler type, a ground-and-pound kind of guy. So there were guys who were doing things in a more diverse way, but they did not have the Frank Shamrock was a star. I mean, he was beating guys quick. He beat Igor Zinoviev quick. He beat Kevin Jackson quick. And in different ways, he picked Zinoviev up, slammed him, knocked him out, and he put Kevin Jackson in an armbar. So he was showing this diversity of skills that other guys like GSP, even Matt Hughes to an extent, had to be more than just a wrestler. So I think that's the fight where you knew you had to have a full complement of skills and a gas tank. And it's you know, kind of motivated Tito Ortiz to become who he was.
And that's why I worded it like what developed following this fight. I know we talked about it a lot last week, but the fact that Tito Ortiz became a better fighter out of a loss in that fight.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that and it kind of set the table for what light heavyweight would be. And listen, at that time, these guys fought all over the map. I mean, Frank Shamrock fought Tito Ortiz, and he fought Boss Rutten. Now, he fought him in Japan, but he fought both of those guys. So it was like there was some lineage there. It was like for Frank Shamrock, you had to have a certain skill set to hang with Boss Rutten and a certain skill set to hang with Tito Ortiz. And I think that Tito never had quite the developed skill set that Frank did, but he kind of, in the same way that Chuck Liddell was kind of a guy looking for one big punch, he did have to have the takedown defense to deal with a guy like Tito, to deal with a guy like Randy. So you knew that you had to have more than just your thing. All right, Craig, in terms of all-time moments, Forrest Griffin versus Stephen Bonner has to be among the top. In 2013, the bout was the first added to the UFC's fight wing and supersedes the main event between Ken Shamrock and Rich Franklin. But a lot of the shine of the season didn't just come from the light heavyweight finale, but from the drama between Chris Leben and Josh Koscheck. Their feud ended in a loser leaves the house fight in episode 6, which ended up drawing 2.2 million viewers. Tough would continue to be a huge success after the first season, but could it have been as successful without Leben and Koscheck?
Wasn't there peeing on mattresses and there was like water fights and stuff? And like this setup, we talked about this before we came on, this setup, Julian Lane and I just want to bang, bro, let me bang. Like season one off the jump was crazy enough that, I mean, I would think that like there's probably, and I know there was reality TV before The Ultimate Fighter, but it probably helped reality TV out in general. And UFC back then, I mean, isn't like it is today. Like we have it on ESPN now, but there was a point where it was on Fox. And then before that it was on Spike. And at one point it was on Fuel. Like it's grown leaps and bounds. And I think The Ultimate Fighter and even the drama between Leben and Koscheck. And it also helps out that after that, they were pretty big stars in the UFC. I mean, say what you want about Josh Koscheck, where he was the bad guy in that circumstance. And then he became the bad guy throughout his career. But he was a pretty good bad guy, like a pretty easy guy to hate. When I first got into MMA, it was 2008, I absolutely hated Josh Koscheck, especially when he fought George St. Pierre. I hated him. I still don't like him that much, but I hated him so much, especially when he fought Tyron Woodley and he knocked him out in 2013. But yeah, I mean, I think it could have been as successful, but if you didn't have ratings like that, I bet you nobody would have maybe seen the finale where you had Griffin and Bonner. That wouldn't have been as big of a deal. And I think that just having that built-in drama, and maybe it didn't have to be those two guys. Maybe Diego Sanchez, before he met Josh Fabia, could have been a really dramatic guy in the first season, or more so than he was when he won it. But I think they definitely added to it, and I don't think you can discount what they did.
Oh, they added to it in a huge way. And I think that I'm going to say something that you know, history has sort of forgotten. No one cared about Stephen Bonner and Forrest Griffin before that fight. It wasn't like they were just, wait, oh my God, this is such a great matchup. We're so excited. Forrest Griffin and Stephen Bonner were exactly what Diego Sanchez and Kenny Florian were. They were just like, and listen, Florian and Sanchez have built careers after Tough, but they didn't build a career because of Tough. They were introduced by Tough, but it was like everything they did after Tough added to what they did on Tough. Koscheck and Lieben, listen, Koscheck was Colby Covington before Colby Covington. And I don't want to say he was Chael Sonnen before Chael Sonnen, because Chael Sonnen turned, he was a lot funnier than Koscheck was, yeah, just a jerk. Colby Covington's just a jerk. Like, that's it. I mean, you know, Colby Covington's a poor ripoff of Chael, but honestly, him and Koscheck are a lot more like. And that's just, I mean, that was Koscheck's gimmick. He was hated. He loved being hated. It made him a lot of money. Biggest mistake he ever made was probably not fighting John Fitch, but that's a story for another day. Yeah, I think that they are the forgotten. Like, that was the storyline that carried the season. Was Lieben going to fight Southworth? Was Lieben going to fight Koscheck? Would Koscheck and Southworth have to fight each other at some point? Like, it was all about what was actually, I think Koscheck and Southworth were probably different divisions, because I know Diego was 85, Koscheck was probably 85, and Southworth, they were light heavies. But, yeah, it was just – that was the, you know, the subplot of the whole entire season. That's what kept people watching. That, Randy and Chuck, I mean, that was what it was. And then, you know, Dana – like, I mean, there was a lot of stars that came out of Tough. Dana went in to the first season of The Ultimate Fighter one guy and came out another guy altogether. So, for me, I think that, you know, all the stuff that he said – it was funny because Dana was talking about, you know, becoming a celebrity off of being on The Ultimate Fighter or becoming a fighter – and cautioning the fighters against that. That's ultimately what happened to him. But to answer the question, yeah, absolutely. This was the biggest. This lets you know that there were compelling stories and there was a reality show worth watching. Because I used to have a joke with my friends for a long time when it came to Tough. And this is horrible, but I'm going to tell you the joke. The joke was, they said to me, why do you watch The Ultimate Fighter? And I said, I watch it for the reality show. And they go, you don't watch it for the fights? I'm like, it's just bad fights. These guys aren't ready for the UFC yet, or they'd be in the UFC. So I'm not watching for the fights. I watch the UFC for the fights. I watch Tough for the reality show. And it was kind of like, you know, The Challenge on MTV. It was ultimately, if all those guys could fight, you'd have Tough. So, yeah, I think Koscheck and Lieben were huge to that situation, 100%.
Yeah, and how many people are talking about the Shamrock Franklin fight these days, really?
No one.
I mean, not a whole lot of people. But one thing that people still talk about, and we're talking right now about Bellator's Roger Huerta. I mean, he might not be the hottest commodity in 2020, but in 2007, the sky was the limit for El Matador. And that year, in May of that year, he graced the cover of Sports Illustrated. At the time, he was 17-1-1, and he ended that year with three more wins near the top end of the UFC's lightweight division. Then he'd lose two fights and he was out of the UFC. But at the time, I mean, I would have been 12. So I didn't really know, you know, what it meant. But for you, what did it mean to have a mixed martial artist on the cover of a major sports publication like Sports Illustrated, you know, for the first time?
It was huge. I mean, there was all these different benchmarks for MMA, you know, getting on TV and getting on, you know, for me, I was a fan of the UFC for a long time, and I was there, and we'll get into this later, when they were kind of going at it with Pride. So any kind of exposure that UFC got that would separate them from Pride or kind of raise them up or from any of these other competing promotions was huge. Now, in retrospect, and even at the time, it was always very curious that Roger Huerta was the guy that ended up on the cover. And it was almost like he happened to be the guy they took up. It wasn't like they were saying, next big thing in MMA is Roger Huerta. They were writing a story about MMA, and Roger Huerta happened to be the guy that they wrote the story around. Like, he was the cover boy. It wasn't – the article wasn't about him. The picture was about him. So it was still huge. But let me tell you how big putting someone like Roger Huerta on the cover is and why that mattered. Roger Huerta did not destroy the world following, you know, or preceding that cover. I mean, he had a nice record, but he wasn't, like, you know, knocking out studs. He's 7-11 after the Sports Illustrated cover. Now, is that the SI curse? We'll get into that in a second. But here's the question. Or here's the thing that I would like to pose to you. After that cover, okay? Before that cover, he fought Leonard Garcia. Then he goes on a 3-fight win streak. So it's Evans, Alberto Crane, Clay Guida. Then he loses to Florian and Maynard, beats some guy named Chad Hinton. But listen, he got a fight with Pat Curran. He got a fight with Eddie Alvarez, both at Bellator. He headlined UWF, whatever that is. But listen, way later in his career, April of 2018, he got to fight Benson Henderson, lost, and then fought Patricky Pitbull.
And his nose caved into his skull in that fight.
But the fact that he got even booked for those fights was because his name was well-known enough to the public based on being the Sports Illustrated cover boy. So it was huge for the – I mean, it's very huge for Huerta, obviously. But even – I mean, just as huge for the promotion, for the sport. It was like this, there's all these gates that are, you know, people keep you and try to keep things out of, right? You're not ready for ESPN. You're not ready for this. You're not ready for that. Sports Illustrated is one of those things, you know, and if you're let into the Sports Illustrated world, you're somehow deemed more serious.
And we're kind of at a weird spot in time now. And if you want to go back and listen to our talk about Dana White and John Jones, please do so. You can find it here on Fight Night Picks now. But the conversation that we had, like, you know, are they going too far trying to market some of their fights right now? Well, they're the only game in town. They have to do stuff like that. And they have a platform that wasn't available to them back in 2007. Like, that was such a big deal to have Roger Huerta. And again, I was 12 or 13 at the time, so I didn't know. But like that looking back was such a big deal. The fact that it wasn't like, this is sad. Because I used to read magazines, but what would have been some other big magazines at the time? Like Sports Illustrated, when I grew up, I used to have Sports Illustrated for kids, and my dad had a Sports Illustrated subscription. I would read them both, like, religiously. Like, it was huge to me. So to have Huerta there, like, just looking back in retrospect, that has to be a big deal. Bigger than, again, I don't know sports magazines from the time, but yeah, such a big deal.
Let me give you an example real quick, all right? Neither Craig nor I are Errol Hawani, right? Errol's in another stratosphere. But so if all of a sudden John Jones popped for a DUI and they asked Craig to be on SportsCenter, that's what it's like when Roger Huerta's on Sports Illustrated. It's overnight, you immediately get exposed to a group of people you had never been exposed to and everything that comes with that. That's exactly what it is. If tomorrow Craig was on SportsCenter, everything would change for him as a journalist.
And it'll never happen.
All right, Craig. In 2007, we had the acquisition of Zuffa. By Zuffa of Pride Fighting Championships, it was interesting. Some talent jumped ship. And fight fans today have a library to go back and watch on Fight Pass. Was it an important acquisition? And by 2013, was it as much of a big deal as it was in 2007?
Pride was notoriously like a sinking ship for the UFC. And I've talked about it recently, and I don't... Again, like 2007, I was 13 or so. I'm trying to think of it. Yeah, I was 13, 12 or 13. So it all depends. But it was in the spring, so I was 12. And yeah, at the time, I was like, hey, Mirko Krokop, Vanderlei Silva, all these guys, UFC is going to get them. There's going to be these super fights. These guys are going to be champions. But I was too young to realize that some of these guys fought in the States and they didn't fight all that well when they fought in the States. And then really looking back into it with Pride 33 and 34, I look back at Pride 33. I talked about it here recently with Fight Night Picks as one of my Perry Encounter, the top five events you have to go back and see, because Nick Diaz fought on it. Dan Henderson fought Vanderlei Silva. Like, there was some great fights on that card, but it was in Vegas and it was really weird because it was like Pride's last big attempt to have an event. And then you go and look at Pride 34, and there's hardly any names on there. I think Butterbean was on it, Eric Esch, and I love Butterbean. But apart from that, like, they were already kind of sinking, if you will. And then when the UFC acquired them, they hardly got all the talent that you thought they were going to get. And again, it's awesome that there's a great library on Fight Pass. But in 2007, what could you do with that? Sell DVDs? I mean, really, like, it didn't amount to a whole lot. So in 2013, people probably hated it. In 2020, it's not terrible because we can go back and watch all of these awesome fights, less the intros and entrances, which I think is kind of the coolest part about Pride. But yeah, in 2007, to me, it was a big deal, but it was weird the way that it shook out.
So quick story.
Please.
I was actually in Vegas for Pride 32. I didn't go to it, but I was in Vegas for it. And I went to the weigh-ins. They did like an open workout and got to it. I got into a screaming match with Phil Baroni. That's a story for another day. But I remember being there and thinking, Pride is here, right? This is Pride 32, the real deal. Fedor Emelianenko, Mark Coleman in the main event, Mauricio Hua, Kevin Randleman in the co-main event. Dan Henderson fought Vitor Belfort on that card. Phil Baroni fought Yosuke Nishima on that card. Robbie Lawler fought on that card. So I remember thinking that this is kind of where guys I wasn't quite sure of yet were fighting guys I had heard of that left the UFC, you know, like Baroni and Coleman and Randleman and Robbie Lawler. But I remember taking it very seriously. I mean, I was a UFC fan, and I wanted UFC to be the one that, that won out in the Pride UFC Wars, and I was concerned. I was concerned that now they've made it to American soil. If this event does well, and the, listen, the gate was $2 million. The buy rate was low, but the gate was $2 million. So then you know, they're a real competitor. Now, little did I know, two events later, I didn't realize the Hail Mary these American fights were, or these American cards were. But yeah, I took it very seriously. Now, in terms of how much did it matter and how much did it matter in 2013? Well, it depends on the division. I think for the 205-pound division, Pride's coming over was incredibly important, right? Because you had...
I mean, Shogun had great fights and became a champion and had a really good UFC career.
Rampage came over immediately, and he had fought Chuck and Pride. There was a time when the UFC and the Pride were supposed to work together. The UFC held up their end of the bargain with Chuck Liddell going to fight Pride. Pride never held up their end of the bargain. They let Wanderlei Silva go into the cage very famously with a Pride shirt on, never booked the fight. The fight took place much later on UFC, under the UFC banner. But, yeah, so Quentin Rampage Jackson came in, took the belt. He fought Dan Henderson and defended it. He Mauricio Shogun Hua had the belt for a minute. And then John Jones came along and, you know, sunk all those ships. But Anderson Silva was a Pride fighter. You know, or had Pride. He necessarily didn't come over when the Pride guys came over, but he had a Pride background. So it depends on the division, but they had some really long-standing champions. And I think it was important only because sometimes to succeed, you have to get rid of your competition. And I think that they were better having been bought out by the UFC than had they been let. And there was some talk of letting both them and Strikeforce, which is a conversation for another day, continue under their own banner, just have the UFC run them.
And just to add to it quick, while it's still fresh in my mind, to give credit where credit's due, and a great Canadian publication, The Score MMA with James Lynch, he had an article that just came out yesterday, 15 biggest UFC free agent busts. On lower end of the totem pole, top end, Mirko Krokop, 4-6 in the UFC, Wanderlei Silva, 5-8, Heath Herring, 2-3, Dennis Kang, who I don't believe fought in Pride, but still, Kid Yamamoto, Tatsuya Kawajiri, Sokaju went 1-2, Gilbert Ivel 0-3, Takanori Gomi 4-9, Hector Lombard from Bellator 3-8, and they gave him that huge contract because he was just wrecking house in Bellator. Martian Held, Will Brooks, Gilbert Melendez, David Branch, Tarek Safady. But at the top end of that list, you have a lot of Pride guys, and that was kind of the story, and that's what I took away was, yeah, like you said, at light heavyweight, great additions. Some of them ended up becoming champions, but at like 265, and even some of the fighters that we're not talking about at 205, they didn't really make as big of an impact as you probably thought they would. So in 2013, I'm sure there are a lot of people that were, you know, it was still fresh wounds. They were probably a little salty, but at the same time, there's a little glimmer of hope where, again, Shogun, Rampage, and if I'm not, was Rampage still with the UFC in 2013?
I don't know if he was. Been flip-flopping with the UFC and Bellator for a minute.
Yeah, so but still, like, yeah, weird situation.
So one thing I want to add, though, is that when they made the purchase, and again, if we're assessing this in 2013 terms, it's a different story, but when we look at the purchase, okay, number one, they didn't know Fedor Emelianenko was not going to come. Number two, they got the fight library, which is huge. Number three, all those guys that you're thinking that even didn't do well were still big enough names in the mixed martial arts community. For example, friend of the show, Brendan Schaub, defeated Mirko Krokop, which is a black mark on the sport for sure. But when he defeated him, that could have been the, you know, the push that he needed to make himself a championship contender. It didn't work out that way. But you could put these Pride guys who had, now listen, depends on who you ask, if their records were inflated based on some, you know, chicanery or tomfoolery over in Japan, but they had a big enough name. A guy like Mirko Krokop's got a highlight reel of knocking guys out. Rampage, highlight reel. Silva. I mean, they had some serious fights. If you just talk about. Henderson, Silva, Hua, Rampage, Krokop. Just those guys. That's a substantial number of great fights that the UFC then got with those guys coming over. And if nothing else, they got their name recognition as names you could put on, you know, the headstones of fighters from UFC that they were taking them out.
Yeah. I mean, we could do a whole show on the Pride acquisition and just what ended up happening. But one of the things that did happen after that was the fact that we got UFC 100. Now, UFC 200 after 2013 did not go on all that great. But one of the fighters that did fight on UFC 200 was close to the top, if not the main event of UFC 200. I can't remember. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm going to keep going with this. Because, John, by the end of 2013, there were 257 total shows with UFC 168 capping off that year. You had a main event of Chris Weidman, Wanderlei Silva, too. But you look at UFC 100, and I mean, it was such a big card. After that, of course, you had UFC 129. It was the biggest card that we had to date, to 2013. But with UFC 100, it was one of those ones, maybe it wasn't the highest attendance, because it was held in Vegas. And, you know, you had some of the biggest names on it, though. And that was one of those things that it had going for it. It had two title fights. You had an unintentional post-limb of John Fitch and Paulo Thiago, which I went back and watched that. And a lot of people say that was a great fight. In my opinion, man, that was not a great fight. Like, to watch Brock Lesnar and Frank Mir too, and then have to watch John Fitch and Paulo Thiago, that was like the Ambien that you needed to go to sleep. But in terms of UFC 100, what kind of an impact did that event make in 2009 to propel the sport in further into the mainstream? Or did it? Did it have that kind of impact that I feel like it did looking back now?
It was huge. And another story, I was in Vegas for this one. I went to a viewing party at Mandalay Bay and ran into Shane Mosley. And, you know, it was a good night. It was fun. But it had a huge impact. And a lot of things that people don't see now that were happening back then. First of all, when you look at George St. Pierre versus Thiago Alves, you cannot even understand the star that Thiago Alves was back then because of what happened after, you know, since then, right? So GSP was a huge star, and he was going against this kid that everybody thought had real chance to take him out. Dan Henderson's knockout of Michael Bisping is iconic, iconic. Right? That was a huge fight. These guys were on the Ultimate Fighter together, talked a ton of crap to each other, and then this was the culmination of that with Henderson just taking his head off, right? So even if the card had been slow, which it hadn't been, but even if it had been, this is the shot in the arm that the card needed, right? Mark Coleman against, well, first of all, Akiyama versus Alan Belcher. You look
that
at that
fight of the night.
It's fight of the night, but you look at the fight now and you're like, why is this even on the main card? They were trying to turn Akiyama into this huge star in the UFC.
I mean, his fight after that, sorry to cut you off, was against Chris Lieben, and it was another fight of the night. And I went back and just watched that, and it is a good fight. I mean, Chris Lieben, like, they go at it. But the Alan Belcher fight, too, yeah. And Akiyama, huge star in Pride. Will he be a huge star in the UFC?
Alan Belcher was a kid we thought we might have something in. Now let's talk about the prelims. Mark Coleman, who's a former, you know, multiple tournament winner, ultimate winner, guy's a Hall of Famer. He's fighting Stephen Bonner, right? Guy who fought Forrest Griffin. John Jones is on the card fighting Jake O'Brien. No one even knows who John Jones is. Jim Miller and Matt Danzig, both Jim Miller is who he is, always had great fights. Matt Danzig is a guy that we thought maybe coming off the Ultimate Fighter. TJ Grant, we thought.
Yeah,
we
were Nova Scotia's TJ Grant losing the stun gun.
Tom Lawler, like in retrospect now, was the real, you know, Brock Lesnar and Frank Mir was the fight. Frank Mir had already beaten him, you know, submitted him, but it was kind of like, you know, he beat him in a way that you could still promote the fight. Like, okay, we understand Brock Lesnar is knowing about submissions. Frank Mir submitted him. You still had some leeway there to still promote a good fight. But, yeah, this card was huge, and it set the table for how big one of those milestone cards should be. Now, a lot of things came into play with UFC 200 not being as exciting of a card or having as much, but it seemed like everything was on the line when it came to UFC 100. Like, it seemed like such an important card, such a big card, all the promotion for it. It was huge, and I think it led to a lot of huge things moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to go back for a second. So yeah, UFC 200, I don't know why I couldn't remember it, but Lesnar and Mark Hunt was co-main. And then in the main, it was Tate and Nunes. And then before that, you had Anderson Silva and Daniel Cormier in a fight that was way too close for comfort for a lot of Daniel Cormier fans.
All right, Craig, let's jump ahead 2 years and the Rogers Centre in Toronto hosts the province of Ontario's first UFC card. 55,724 fans attended. It was a wild card with Jose Aldo facing Mark Hominick for the featherweight belt in the co-main event and GSP defending his belt against Jake Shields in the main event. Plenty of Canadians on the card, some great fights in general. How big was this card for MMA? How big was it for Canadian MMA in particular? How big was it for GSP? Like, give me some perspective on UFC 129.
I mean, they were fighting to have a card in Ontario for a long time. And I know the narrative and the story goes, like, they pulled this together within a matter of under a year to get this to happen, not just in Toronto. It could have happened in Peterborough. It could have happened in Mississauga. It could have happened in Thunder Bay. It could have happened in Timmins, although it probably wouldn't. But Toronto is one of the biggest cities, of course, in North America, cultural hub. And obviously, we see at least one pay-per-view card from Toronto per year, typically. So for them to have this card, and normally they go to, now it's what, Scotiabank Arena, used to be the Air Canada Center. They go there quite often. But for them to have that first card at the Rogers Center, which is one of the biggest baseball stadiums out there, and it's special and unique because where they had the octagon is in the middle of the ball diamond. And it's a field that currently they don't have grass. They throw some dirt in there, but it's all on top of concrete. So it's a multi-use event center where they could have such a big event like this and to stack it name value-wise with big names like that. Of course, GSP, Jake Shields in the main event. Maybe that's not the most exciting fight, but at the time, GSP was the biggest star, if not in MMA, at least in Canada. And one of those guys that certainly got myself, and I know, the typical co-host, your Matt Allen. I mean, we were all over George St. Pierre at the time. We had all the Under Armour gear at the time. And then Jose Aldo, Mark Hominick, again, another Canadian. Rory McDonald was on the card. John McDessie was on the card. There were plenty of Canadians on that card. So in terms of how big was it for Canadian MMA, it was huge because you had, you know, one of your biggest provinces hosting the biggest event that we've really seen. I mean, yeah, we had UFC go to Marvel Stadium in Australia and top some of these attendance records. And they've done some crazy things in Brazil, too. But at the time, this was huge. UFC 129 is one of those events that I like to go back and watch. And I already have gone back and watched some of the fights here this week in the absence of fights.
You know, I'm an old head. We talk about it all the time. But when I look at this card, listen, first of all, GSP was my guy. I'm sure he was your guy. He was everybody's guy. I mean, there was something about him that just made him different. And when he came to the ring and he had the gi on and he had the headband on, I mean, there are certain guys that you can sort of, even though you know they're great, you can still make them seem vulnerable. GSP had that thing where even though you knew he was the most dominant fighter in the world, we could believe that, you know, Thiago Alves or Dan Hardy or Josh Koscheck or, and, you know, the guys that preceded this Jake Shields fight or Jake Shields all kind of had a shot. You could build yourself up to believe that. And I think this, either this fight or the next fight, was the absolute peak of GSP's. He was at the height of his powers in terms of as a draw. Now, where it gets a little bit funky here is that this is, you know, ended up being the fourth of like six or seven decisions in a row. So he started to get that rep a little bit, especially among casuals. I had a buddy of mine, we'd all get together for fights, hated GSP because he would go to decision. But for me, my pushback against that has always been, he did it in style though. Like, it never felt like he wasn't trying to, he wasn't working towards something. He wasn't one of these guys that just took a guy down and that was it. Even when he took a guy down, he was always trying to advance his position. He was always trying to like do ground and pound. Like, he was a phenomenal striker on the feet. So, but listen, if we talk about the rest of this card now, you know, even casuals, Jose Aldo, Mark Hominick, Lyoto Machida knocking out Randy Couture. Okay, we'll forgive the Matyushenko, Jason Brill's fight, but Benson Henderson against Mark Bocek, Rory McDonald against Nate Diaz. I mean, this was a card.
Rory McDonald, Nate Diaz. So he wins that fight and Rory McDonald wins 30-26, 30-27, 30-26. And at that point in time, Rory McDonald was the next George St. Pierre to a lot of people and especially to Canadians. There was a TriStar connection. He was, of course, a lot younger. He would go on to fight in big fights and maybe not live up to, of course, you know, never won the belt, never able to defend it as many times as George St. Pierre if you don't win the belt. But still, like, a win like that in a featured prelim against a big name in Nate Diaz that had already kind of established himself for a very long time, like, that's a huge fight, especially coming off of a big win for Jake Ellenberg in the fight before that. So you're right. I mean, just a card that, like, yeah, I mean, maybe people aren't going to remember the wins of Ivan Menjivar or Pablo Garza on the, you know, the start of the prelims, but still, like, huge card.
Huge card, not a bad night for Canada. I mean, Mark Hominick loses, you know, Mark Bocek loses, Sean Pearson loses, but, I mean, GSP wins, McDonald wins, Claude Patrick wins, you know, I mean, it was, I thought it was a good night for Canada. Jason McDonald, haven't heard that name in a while. He picked up a win. I think that, I mean, I don't want to call this the biggest night in Canadian MMA history, but it was a big night. So, you know, my Google Home just went off. But, yeah, it was a big deal. So, all right. I think we've covered it.
I mean, as long as Google Home's cool with it, the other thing about that was they switched a couple of things with the show, because you had your pay-per-view portion, you had a little bit of the prelims on Spike, and then a majority of the prelims on Facebook. And then one of the big things that happened preceding that was the fact that UFC ended up debuting on Fox not that long after, which was a really big deal. You know, there's finally, you know, some legitimacy to the sport, and all of a sudden the biggest game in town is moving or making the move from Spike over to Fox. And you already had Strikeforce, they were with a big network, but now all of a sudden the UFC had made a power play to be on in front of the masses. And the first event that they had with Fox was Junior Dos Santos, Cain Velasquez for the title in the main event. I mean, we're on ESPN in 2020, but how big was it to have Fox in growing the brand and the sport at the time?
It was huge. I mean, you know, I think Fox has so many, like, different entities and branches and all these different ways it goes that sometimes you forget exactly how huge Fox is, right? Like, you think, oh, well, you just say, okay, it's Fox News, or, oh, it's FX, or, oh, it's, you know, the movie company. But, like, you know, NFL football's on Fox, right? That's that to me, and especially when the UFC made the move to Fox, that was the big thing that everybody said, okay, this is big time now. This is where the NFL is. This is where Terry Bradshaw and Howie Long and all those guys are. To me, I think that it was much bigger, even though Fox is a smaller network than CBS. The UFC on Fox is way bigger than Strikeforce on CBS. And the crazy part is a lot of what the UFC did was on these sort of like, you know, sister stations of Fox, not like FS1 or whatever. And Strikeforce was mostly on like either Showtime or like big CBS, because CBS really didn't have that secondary cable outlet at the time. So, yeah, I mean, listen, the JDS Velasquez fight seems huge when they announced it, ended up not being that great of a fight in the end. But yeah, it's just, it was finally like all these little milestones that say, okay, this is, you're making it to the big time. You're getting closer to what now. And then, you know, if we spin this forward to now, the Fox deal sets the table for the ESPN deal. And I think that ESPN wasn't quite ready to commit to MMA. They wanted somewhere else to work out all the bugs, work out all the kinks, and then once they got to ESPN, it was ready to go.
And a lot of people now in 2020 are familiar with the fact that, yeah, the Fox pacing, maybe it wasn't that great, this and that. They were pretty nitpicky, and it seems pretty well that, you know, things have been smooth sailing with ESPN. But you're right, to the point that Fox had to work out the kinks to make sure that it would work for a major network, and then ESPN kind of took that torch, invested a lot of money into it, and all of a sudden they've had this polished product where you still get complaints, but still, for this to happen, you know, pre-2013, this was huge in not just growing the sport, but yeah, really developing it. And you look at some of these cards that they had even early on, they were huge, especially, you know, Demetrius Johnson was a staple of some of the Fox cards. And, you know, it's not a knock on him, but it was just something that they did. And they had a lot of title fights in a short period of time. And you talked about that fight between Cain Velasquez and Junior Dos Santos. Maybe The result wasn't what a lot of people had hoped for, but still, it set up more big fights, and it was ultimately a good thing for the sport in general. And again, in terms of legitimacy, you're going from Spike, which I know growing up in the boonies in Canada, Spike was one of those channels that was way up there. Like, I think it was in the 600s. It was way up there. And, you know, you were watching, it's just like Bellator now. If you're watching by tape delay, you're watching Bar Rescue and, you know, Ink Master and this and that. And all of a sudden, you could be going from a NASCAR or some other major sport over to MMA. It was huge at the time. And really, in terms of growing stars, too. I mean, in 2013, you had arguably your biggest star in the sport debuting with the promotion of Conor McGregor. If Fox wasn't there and Conor McGregor was on Spike, I don't think it would have translated the same way.
I agree. And listen, you could say, you could look at that two ways. You could say either Conor would have, you know, completely raised the profile of Spike and made Spike a must-have channel because Conor's just Conor. Or you could say that, you know, Fox helped. There's a lot of things that helped Conor. Now, listen, they say guys that are stars, guys that are meant to be, guys that have that something extra like Adesanya or Conor or whatever whoever these guys are, they are presented opportunities. And when those opportunities are presented, they take full advantage of them. You know, you could grind out a win over Jose Aldo. You could knock him out in 13 seconds. I mean, one makes you a star and one doesn't, right? So I think that, you know, Conor definitely did what he needed to do. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, if not for Fox and if not for that type of a brand name, who knows where stars like Conor and Ronda and, you know, a lot of people that kind of went into the stratosphere may not have went into the stratosphere if those fight night cards were on Spike.
And the other thing about, you know, Fox at that time, you know, thanks a lot for keeping Jay and Dan hostage for a little bit in the States. And then they spit them right back out because some things just didn't happen to work out with Fox.
That's true. All right, Craig, I'm going to throw a surprise segment at you because why not?
That's fair.
We're getting ready to get out of here. So first 20 years, let's do a rank them. Top 10 most important people in the first 20 years of the UFC, and if you want to expand it to MMA, we could do that. If you want to, like, just have a preliminary list, I'll say it. We can move some guys around. And then we'll start the conversation. I did a podcast about this, so I don't want to, like, sort of push you in a certain direction. But I want to start the conversation to be who should be remembered differently from the first 20 years.
Well, that's an easy one.
So, okay, well, I'm glad. I just wanted to plant the seed in case you didn't have something. All right, let's start with ranking them. 10 to 1 or 1 to 10?
Let's go 1 to 10.
All right, so the most important person first. Who's the most important person in the first 20 years of the MMA or the UFC?
Would it be Art Davies?
It could be. It could be. Here's where that gets interesting for me. And listen, I interviewed Art Davies. He was a hell of a nice guy. I interviewed him at the Palms in Vegas a couple years ago. He's the creator but it was kind of him, Rory and Gracie, Campbell McLaren. You know, the more you know about the story, the more you know that you got to kind of spread the wealth around a little bit there. So the question becomes, who's more relevant, Dana White or Art Davies, if you had to choose?
Probably Dana White. But, you know, if it was me, I would say, and I'm glad you brought those names up, Art, Horian, Campbell McLaren, lump everybody in. Maybe not as one, but have them at least up near the top and put all of them there. Because without any of them, like, if you didn't have any of those guys, you wouldn't have had the UFC.
All right, this is interesting. So I'm going to hold you to this, okay? So let's do this. Let's do Art, Horian, Campbell, 1, 2, and 3.
Four. All right. Now I'm getting controversial.
Okay,
and four. And I'm still going to go – I'm going early. So this is first 20 years, but I'm still going to stick it early. Ken Shamrock, number 4.
Ken Shamrock, number 4, okay.
Hoist Gracie, number 5.
Hoist Gracie, number 5.
Good question, John. I'm glad you asked. Why Ken ahead of Hoist Gracie? Because Hoist Gracie was unassuming and Ken Shamrock could sell.
Fair enough. Okay. So now you've listed all these guys. We got Art Davies. We got Horian Gracie. We have Campbell McLaren. We have Ken Shamrock. We have Hoist Gracie. Are we ever going to get to Dana White? Is he even in the top 10, Craig? I mean, Jesus.
Frittita brothers, are they considered one or are they considered two?
The Fertitta brothers, I would say that, yeah, we consider them one.
Oh, we consider them one? Okay.
They speak in a unified front. Is that fair?
Okay, I'll put Dana White next, okay, after Ken and Hoist. Then I've got the Fertitta brothers.
Okay.
So how? What number am I at now?
We're at eight.
Eight? So I have two left. Who were the first two big stars in the
UFC? You have three left. Eight, nine, and ten.
Oh, geez. I really screwed this one up. Chuck Liddell and Tito Ortiz.
Chuck Liddell. Tito Ortiz.
Yeah, and that's leaving a lot of people out.
Okay.
But to me, it's credit where credit's due from a business sense. Then you've got Dana White and the Fertitta brothers coming in and expanding. You've got your first wave of two stars in Ken Shamrock and Hoist Gracie, and then you've got your two next stars in Tito Ortiz and Chuck Liddell. To me. Now, there's gaps in there, I know, but still.
Okay, I need one more guy.
Well, I thought that was 10.
No, Art Davey 1, Horian Gracie 2, Cam McLaren 3, Ken Shamrock 4, Hoist Gracie 5, Dana White 6, the Fertitta brothers 7. I put them together at 7. Chuck Liddell 8, Tito Ortiz 9.
Oh, boy, 10. Listen, I'll go with a Canadian who now I got to get my props here. And I brought his name up and it's on the tip of my tongue every week now. And Harold Clarence Howard from Niagara Falls, Canada, who said, if you're coming on, come on. No, I'm not actually throwing him in there. This is really tough. I don't know what to have for 10. I mean, I was able to reason and justify all my 9. If I had to pick 10.
I'll give you two. I'll give you two that make sense. Randy Couture and George St. Pierre.
Yeah, I was thinking Couture. I'd probably go Couture. That one's fair.
So you're saying that all of this, okay, now let's start talking here, because 2013, George St. Pierre's last fight, St. Pierre fought Nick Diaz in 2013. He fought Johnny Hendricks in 2013. So his entire career happened before 2013. So, but you're sticking with Art, Rory, and Campbell, Ken, Hoist, Dana, the Fertitta brothers, Chuck, Tito, Randy.
I'm fine with that.
All right, I am going to change things around a little bit.
That's fine.
All right, I'm going to go I'll give you Art. 2, I got Dana. Now, that's very unfair to Horian Gracie. Okay, cuz he was the guy really that him and Art kind of, you know, it's one of those things where it's like what they call it, serendipity, where two guys are having the thought at the same time. So, I'm going to go with, and it's funny, you know, guys, because people that don't know the story, the origin story, your Art, Horian, and Campbell are really in a very significant way, each individually as important to the creation of UFC. Horian brought in the Gracies, and it was partly his idea. Art had like a lot of the logistical idea of it in terms of like, you know, the different fighting styles, the octagon, and Campbell was the one by all accounts that got him on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So all three of them are necessary for this thing to get off the ground. So in that respect, I do like where you're coming from. But I'm going to go Art, Dana. I'm going to go Campbell, Horian. Actually, I'm going to go Horian, Campbell. I'm going to put Hoist ahead of Ken. I do agree with you that Ken was able to sell better, but I do think that Hoist was generally regarded as a star. You know what? I don't want to put the Fertitta brothers in here, but I feel like I have to. You know what? 7? I got to do it, man. I'm putting GSP at 7.
That's fair.
I know that these other guys had much more of a financial impact, but I think that George St. Pierre made it a he brought Canada to the table in a way that no one else had. And I think Canada – there was a time when – so if you're ranking – and maybe we'll get this down the road somewhere. But if you're ranking, like, most important fan bases to the success of the UFC, it was sort of like the U.S., Brazil. And then there was a time period where Canada – was like neck and neck with most important people that were following the sport. Like there, like the Canadian media gave more attention to UFC at times than the American media did. So okay, I'm gonna go with GSP. Then I'm gonna go with Tito. Then I'm gonna go with Chuck. And then I'm gonna go with Randy was a big deal. I really don't. I think if Randy didn't exist, he's the guy you could take out and it'd still be the same. I hate to say it because the way they promoted him was they really rode his coattails for a minute. But I think that if you took him out and you still had Tito and Chuck and Ken, you would have been fine. So I'm going to take
What?
Randy out, put the Fertittas in.
What about, and we talked about top heavyweights last week, where does Brock Lesnar fit into all this?
He should fit into this in a big way. Because, yeah, he kind of, I guess I'd put him at 11. And you know what? I mean, listen, if we really start getting funky, I don't even know when Ronda's last fight was, probably 2015, 2016. She's probably in the second wave, but she was right there on the fringes. All right, let's get to start the conversation, guys. This is kind of where we tip our cap to MMA Reddit, and we get a discussion going. I guess we kind of did with Rank'em anyway, get a discussion going, but let's get a different one going. Who's the person that you think should be remembered differently, or the history books were not written in their favor in the first 20 years of the history of UFC?
It's a guy who happened to be a UFC champion when they dissolved the division, and he won the belt against Cal Uno. He beat Dennis Hallman. He beat BJ Penn, and everybody writes him off. Or they play the hipster pick like I'm doing right now, and they say, oh, he should be in the Hall of Fame. Come on, he's overlooked. But at one point, and I'm talking about a guy from Sunnyside, Washington, Jens Pulver, was 14-2-1, and he was beating, you know, good names. His only loss to that point was to, well, he lost to Dean Thomas, had a draw against Alfonso Alcaraz, and lost to David Harris in his second pro fight. Like, this was one of those guys that was a world beater at the time. He was a lightweight champ, defended it, no more lightweight, and then he just goes away. He beats Rob Emerson, he loses to Bang Ludwig, and then after that, you know, eventually it kind of goes downhill. But the losses are just still really good fighters. Takanori Gomi, he beat, Cub Swanson way back when, lost to Joe Lozon, BJ Penn, and then, you know, we get into the Uriah Fabers, the Josh Grispies, the Leonard Garcias, the best of WEC. But at a time, UFC lightweight champion that nobody really remembers, he deserves a Hall of Fame, you know, banner, or at least a picture there, or a footnote or something. And he doesn't get the recognition, and the UFC just kind of decides to forget about him and not talk about him.
You know, I agree. So I'm not going to tell you that I don't agree with that.
Or Bill, what's his name? Is it Bill Superfoot Wallace? Is that the guy's name?
Bill Superfoot Wallace. Yeah, he deserves. He doesn't get the credit he deserves as well. Jim Brown doesn't get deserved.
Yeah, you know, Cleveland Browns legend Jim Brown on commentary. Why?
Let me tell you something. I used to make it my business to go to Hall of Fame inductions. It was my favorite thing to do in all of MMA. Like, more than covering fights, more than going to fights, going to Hall of Fame inductions was my favorite thing. I went there the year they inducted Brian Baumgartner, and he really, you really want to get into the history of, he was an early commentator, but if you really want to get into the history of UFC, Brian Baumgartner was a big deal. I'm going to put him aside just for a second. You know, it's funny. I was watching this show, Open Court. They do the TNT guys all get together and talk about basketball. And they were going around and they were asking everybody, who's the guy that gave you the most trouble? And somebody picked, like, Magic Johnson. And Kenny Smith went crazy. He's like, you can't pick a Hall of Famer as the guy that gives you – he gave everybody trouble. So I can't – your guy is definitely underrated, and it was a fantastic pick. I'm debating here whether I should go with Tito or Ken. Both of those guys are Hall of Famers. I did a podcast once that got lost in history. And you know what's funny? I'm going to redo the same podcast with a better guest at some point, because I kind of have a little bit of a working relationship with the guy that did the 30 for 30 on Tito and Chuck. He's the guy I'm going after, but that's neither here nor there. But the point of the podcast was, it was called Revisionist MMA. And it's like, if you look back on something in the history of MMA and look at it differently. And the thing that I said was, do we look at Chuck and Tito incorrectly? Do we give too much credit to Chuck and not enough credit to Tito for all of this? Well, I can make the same case for Ken. Like, Ken was there. Ken reminds me of Ric Flair. And he reminds me of Ric Flair in this way. Ric Flair was the greatest wrestler forever by getting beat up and being the guy that had to cheat. And, like, he put guys over forever. Like, Ric Flair had to be good enough so that when someone beat him, you immediately associated his greatness with their greatness. And that's what I think about Ken Shamrock. He was good enough for when Hoist beat him, it meant something. He was good enough for that when Tito beat him, it meant something. He was good enough to go in there with Rich Franklin. Like, he was just always the guy who had to get his ass whipped to let you know somebody else was good. And I think that him, I think he and Tito are looked at because of their issues with the UFC. And honestly, doing what they should be doing for themselves, which is advocating for themselves. I think the two of those guys kind of have gotten a pretty raw deal in the history books. Now, if I'm going to give a pick like yours, it's Frank Shamrock. Frank Shamrock's the guy who has an issue with Dana, who really was the first, one of the first mixed martial artists, true mixed martial artists in the history of the UFC. So Tito, Frank, Ken would be one of the, that's a horrible answer to give three when you're asking a question. You only gave one.
And two of them are Shamrocks.
Two of them are Shamrocks. But it's luck of the Irish. But yeah, that those would be my guys.
Yeah, I mean, I just went back and watched Strike Force Houston, Jacare versus, what was his name? This is crazy that it's evading me. Special Forces, Tim Kennedy. Watched that card today, and Frank Shamrock on commentary with a full set of top and bottom metal braces, adult braces, Frank Shamrock. But no, all that aside, great fighter and a guy that, yeah, you're right, totally overlooked by everybody now. Like, they only see certain aspects. They don't go back and maybe watch the fights, which you definitely should. I mean, that's one of the things with this throwback edition. Like, you know, maybe you're not totally familiar with UFC 129, or maybe you're not overly familiar with some of the other topics that we brought up. Go back and watch them. Or some of these, like, late edition Pride events. Maybe Pride 34 sucked, but like you said, Pride 32 was popping. Pride 33, I really liked it. Like, it's one of my top five cards to go back and watch. So it's definitely, you know, a bit of a refresher to go back and look at some of these fights. Or the Tito and Shamrock fight, like you said.
Yeah, and if you're fans of other sports, I mean, there are people that you only would know if you were watching the sport at the time, right? I was a huge fan of basketball in the 90s. So guys like Bernard King, guys like Michael Adams, guys like Bob McAdoo, these are guys that, like, if you go back and watch their stuff, they're like Frank Shamrock. Like, at the time, they cooked everybody. But in retrospect, you're just like, okay, who are these guys? Like, you, they don't make the like, if you're going to talk about the entire history of the NBA, you might say a few words about Bernard King. That's how Frank Shamrock is kind of looked at. But in his day, he was the biggest thing in all of, I mean, he was a cover boy for all of the, you know, mixed martial arts magazines. Like, he was the guy. And honestly, he just knew his worth, and he wasn't able to accept what the UFC wanted to give him, and he had to go elsewhere. But he's definitely someone they got forgotten over time based on. And again, like Craig said, this is the opportunity to go back and look at some of those fighters and kind of get yourself caught up, because there is no time to get caught up when the UFC is rocking and rolling like they always are. If you want to be a fan, there's a card all, there's no time to get caught up. This is the time to kind of go back and look at some of those fighters from the past and see, you know, and especially if you've never watched them before and you're a young fan, you have a unique perspective, because you can watch a guy, like, I watch a guy, I saw him originally. When you watch a guy and you've never seen him fight and you've only seen newer fights and newer fighters, you can say to yourself, wow, this guy fights like, you know, Jose Aldo. This guy fights like, you know, Corey Sandhagen. Like, you know what I mean? You can see that.
Watching KJ Nunes on that card between Kennedy and Jacare. Holy smokes, KJ Nunes was a world beater. His boxing was great at lightweight. And then he went up to welterweight and fought, who was it?
Charles Bennett?
Who's that?
When Crazy he fought Horse Charles Bennett, felony? Crazy no. Horse. Yeah. When he fought Crazy Horse, that changed everything.
He fought Masvidal, and then there was another fight for the welterweight title after he won a lightweight fight. But that's neither here nor there. KJ Nunes, guy to go back and watch. Because if you just came into the UFC in, you know, the 2000, well, after 2013, KJ Nunes' UFC career was fairly lackluster. Like, his last fight was against Josh Berkman, and he lost.
See, this is why I love this show, because I just had an idea for a segment, just sitting here running through this. Next time, guys, if we're still under, you know, all the situations are the same, and we're still talking like throwback stuff or kind of like history stuff, we're going to do a segment called Ask Your Dad About. Basically, ask your dad about, it's going to be like, ask your dad about KJ Nunes. Hey, go ask your dad about Frank Shamrock. I think we should just make a list of guys that you can go ask your dad about. All right, guys. There you have it. The first full-length episode of Early Stoppage with Fight Night Picks is in the books. Be sure and comment, subscribe, and follow along on iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube. We have some great content coming down the pipe for 2020. And adding this show to the fold is just a start. Craig can be followed at Craig Allen FMP. I can be followed at SM Cornerman. The fight has been stopped. We'll see you next time. Craig, say something witty.
As we always say, listen, John, I want to say this. People always want a Fight Night Picks. Half the crowd wants me to say subscribe, toss me a like, which we do in this show. The other half wants me to go with the slogan that I use in every single show. Let's get into it.
All right, guys, we're going to get out of it for now. We'll see you next time.